2018 saw many important cases and issues that will shape False Claims Act enforcement today and in the years to come. In this five-part podcast series, we'll analyze some key developments to help you better be prepared if the government comes calling with tough questions. In this episode, we'll visit with Hogan Lovells partner Gaja Gobena and senior associate Sarah Marburg from our Washington, D.C. office as they discuss the continued power of Escobar in FCA matters.
I'm Gaja Gobena. Thanks for joining us today, where Sarah and I will be talking about the continuing effect that Escobar is having on False Claims Act jurisprudence. We've seen a lot of developments in the last couple of years, which we're going to talk a little bit about today. In addition, we're also going to be a little forward-looking as well to see where we think Escobar is going to be going, both in terms of its effect on False Claims Act jurisprudence, as well as some practical developments that we see happening in light of the decision itself, as well as some DOJ enforcement policies that have come into effect in the past year.
This is Sarah Marburg. Thanks, Gaja. Escobar was a much anticipated Supreme Court decision from 2016. And the first part of that decision was a ruling on the legitimacy and the viability of an implied false certification theory of False Claims Act liability. And the Supreme Court said that that is a viable theory and explained that this theory can be a basis for False Claims Act liability, at least where two conditions are satisfied. First, the claim does not merely request payment, but also makes specific representations about the goods or services provided. And second, the defendant's failure to disclose noncompliance with material, statutory, regulatory, or contractual requirements makes these representations misleading half-truths. So one of the questions that has arisen since Escobar is, what does that mean? Is that a strict requirement, or is that some guidance on what could be an implied false certification theory of liability?
What's interesting about the decision is that if you looked at the jurisprudence leading up to the Escobar decision, there really wasn't much controversy as to whether or not there was an implied certification theory that was viable. I mean, a lot of courts had already accepted the implied certification theory. So in some ways, the fact that the Supreme Court recognized it, while it did kind of cement that notion in the law, implied certification theories had been the basis of government investigations for under the False Claims Act for years. But what they did inject, interestingly, was that uncertainty about, you know, how do you prove falsity, for example, under the implied certification theory. And they unhelpfully used the term at least, which is not exactly a paragon of clarity. And that's where we see in the court struggle, it looks like, over the last couple of years.
So one of the recent opinions that addressed this question is Stevens Institute coming out of the Ninth Circuit from earlier in 2018. And in that case, the court addressed this question that you just posed, which is, does this test that the Supreme Court said is at least what is required mean the only way that this theory can be shown? And what the Ninth Circuit held is that it is. This is the way, the formula to prove implied false certification, not one of the possible ways to do this. And the Ninth Circuit did this with some hesitation, and rather than explaining why this should be the only way to prove implied false certification, looked to some previous cases interpreting Escobar from the Ninth Circuit and basically said that the court was bound by its previous cases to hold that this was the only way. But the court seemed to come to this conclusion kicking and screaming.
Yeah, it was with great hesitation. They basically invited an en banc review of the decision that they themselves were issuing, feeling that they were bound by that previous precedent in the Ninth Circuit. So it's clear that they came to that conclusion with great reluctance, but it wasn't as if they were doing it in a vacuum. There were certainly other circuits that had similarly held the test laid out in Escobar were necessary to show falsity. So for example, the First Circuit, U.S. Exrel Nargol versus Dupuy Orthopedics, and also the Seventh Circuit case of United States versus Sanford Brown, those are both instances where circuit courts, in addition to the Ninth Circuit, had found that both elements of the test laid out in Escobar were required. By contrast, there was a decision in the U.S. Exrel Bader v. Triple Canopy in the Fourth Circuit, which concluded that a misleading half-truth that's consistent with Escobar could alone establish implied certification. It's been joined since then by other courts, mostly district courts in the District of Columbia. So there's a circuit split clearly developing there, and it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. But when the Ninth Circuit, you know, as you put it, were dragged into their holding, kicking and screaming, they're clearly doing it consistent with other circuit courts. And frankly, what they did and the conclusions that they reached are really consistent with, I think, everybody's understanding that the False Claims Act is an anti-fraud statute. So approving both elements seems to me, anyways, to be a minimum that you should have when you're enforcing a fraud statute or certainly evaluating whether or not fraud has taken place against the government. So, Sarah, the other part of Escobar, in addition to the falsity element that was addressed, was the issue of materiality. And this is another area that's being hotly litigated within the False Claims Act jurisprudence in the last 2 years since the decision was issued.
Thanks, Gajah. So the second thing that the Escobar decision did was articulate a materiality standard that applied in False Claims Act cases. And the court moved to materiality in the decision by saying that this was a way to limit the extent of liability, that if implied certification opened the door to many more ways of showing falsity, materiality was a way to cabin that in ways to make sure that justice was served and how these cases moved forward. And so what the Supreme Court did in Escobar is explained what it called was a rigorous and demanding materiality standard. And it said that materiality looks to the effect on the likely or actual behavior of the recipient of the alleged misrepresentation and sort of laid out the things that can't be material. The court then went on to go through what it considered strong evidence of materiality. So the question then becomes, how do lower courts interpret these examples, this lengthy explanation in Escobar right. of what materiality is, and then how do defendants and also relators go about proving or disproving materiality in cases? And so that's where we've seen a lot of development in courts over the last 2 years since Escobar was issued, with opinions from many circuits explaining what materiality requires or doesn't require.
It's interesting because it has an impact both in terms of kind of what kind of legal defenses you can assert as well as sort of practically what happens in these cases in terms of discovery. So one of the issues that occurred to me was when I saw the decision was a topic that was hotly contested when I was back in the civil fraud division back in the 2000s. And at the time, I was one of the lead prosecutors pushing these AWP drug pricing cases. And throughout those cases, the defense that seemed to be asserted and that was really at the core of a lot of the discovery was government knowledge, right? The government knew that drug prices that it was using to set the baseline for reimbursements were inflated and continued to pay. And we fought those vigorously. And at the time, there's a really strong case to be made that, you know, government knowledge is not just simply knowing about something, but approving it. What's interesting, I think, about the shift here in Escobar is that it kind of takes away that latter part, right? Which is Escobar indicates that, you know, in government knowledge type defenses, if the government knows and continues to pay, the burden's really not so much on the defendant anymore to show that they affirmatively approved of it. By continuing to pay, that is enough of an approval to implicate materiality as defined in the Escobar decision. So I think from a legal perspective, it kind of opens the door to make arguments that had been a little bit more challenging to make before Escobar was issued as a decision. And then obviously the other practical, more fact-gathering implication of the Escobar decision is, how do you go about proving what the government intended, which is key to the determination of materiality? And we've certainly seen more aggressive efforts on the part of defendants to explore those issues. And when the government's a party, it's a little bit easier because they're a party and they're subject to discovery like any other civil defendant in a case. But a lot of times these cases are being pursued by relators and the government has declined to intervene. In which case, they're not a party. Interesting issues that pop up there in terms of how you can get information from the government to be able to build your case about the alleged noncompliance being non-material.
And this is definitely an area where we're going to see case law develop. We're going to see courts having to address issues that come up as defendants and even relators grapple with the practical effect of Escobar's decision, which is really an invitation to seek discovery from the government. In many of these cases, as you mentioned, they have been declined by the government. So the government, while the party in interest, is not the party leading the charge on a day-to-day basis. They're monitoring the case instead. And what we may see is both from a practical and a legal perspective, case law developing about how the government should be treated in those instances. And so the case law that currently exists, which is fairly sparse, says that in a declined case, the government is actually a third party. And so discovery on the government would be conducted like discovery on any other party through Rule 45 subpoenas. But the added twist, which is going to make this more interesting legally and probably practically, is that the government isn't just a regular third party like a bank or a hospital. Instead, the government has what are called TUI regulations that are promulgated by each agency. And these regulations give the agency itself a lot of discretion to decline to participate in these discovery efforts, either by limiting the people who are available for depositions, limiting the documents that are produced by the agency, and also limiting substantively what kinds of questions could be asked of individuals. And what we may see here developing going forward are creative ways to obtain documents from the government. One of the ways that may become a bigger part of discovery efforts in QTAM litigation are FOIA requests to the government, which can be issued at any time and can seek the same sorts of documents and don't have relevancy requirements in the same way that a Rule 45 subpoena might. So we think that that may be something that develops as a tactic adopted by either relators or defendants seeking information from the government. But we also think that another growing area may be litigation about those TUI requests should parties choose to go the normal civil litigation discovery under the federal rules approach to this. And so you may see motions to compel being put before district courts where defendants or relators are asking the court to weigh in on an agency's decision to use the TUI regulations to limit the discovery that the agency is actually producing.
To tap into my experience as a former government prosecutor, I mean, when I was pushing civil False Claims Act cases or litigating them, when you're a party, you sort of have to get your client, which are the agencies, to understand, look, this is litigation, it's civil litigation, it's, you know, ostensibly to your benefit, but you're going to have to deal with the burden of discovery. And that's just something we have to talk about and understand going forward. I think in a decline case, a lot of times it's a little bit more challenging for the agencies because now, you know, yes, they are the party in interest, but let's just be real. I mean, if a case is declined, a lot of times it's because the government thinks that the merits of them are questionable at best. And so now you have agencies who are dealing with really burdensome discovery, you know, having to trot out all the key employees with respect to the issue, have to seek and get a bunch of documents. And so I can see a couple things happening. Number one is an attempt to sort of use TUI aggressively, and it'll be interesting to see how courts are receptive to that. Again, TUI has not been really litigated very heavily. I think that's in large part because historically in decline cases where TUI would be applicable, relators didn't tend to go forward. It's only in the last, I think, 5 to 10 years where we see a lot more activity in decline cases with relators going forward, such that TUI is implicated a lot more frequently than it had been historically. So now it's going to be, I think, a bigger issue in terms of agencies having to deal with these requests. And it'll be interesting to see to what extent they can limit under TUI when materiality has been highlighted by the Supreme Court with respect to establishing FCA liability. I mean, defendants have to have a chance to make that materiality argument. So it'll be interesting to see how those two forces, TUI and government interest in not being burdened, clash with the defendant's interest in exploring as deeply as possible what the government knew and whether or not they effectively sanctioned the conduct such that it was immaterial from a False Claims Act perspective. I think the other thing you will see other than that sort of legal battle is sort of practically, is the government going to decide, you know what, in these decline cases, we need to sort of conserve resources here and be a little bit more assertive in declining cases. And burden to the government is oftentimes a reason why the government does exercise that authority to dismiss claims under the False Claims Act.
One of the really interesting developments is the cases that we see that are being dismissed after having been declined when materiality seems to be one of the issues that's driving the government's decision to, sometimes years after declination, decide to dismiss the case. So one of the fairly recent at this point developments is the government's statement of interest in the Supreme Court in the Campy case that came out of the Ninth Circuit. So in that case, QTAM was brought against Gilead, and the Ninth Circuit found that the relator had adequately pled materiality, which reversed the district court and would have sent the case back to start discovery, move forward, and be fully litigated on materiality and other issues. And before that happened, Gilead sought review by the Supreme Court, and the court actually invited the United States through the Solicitor General to file a statement of interest. And the Solicitor General filed a statement of interest where they said that the United States basically agreed with the Ninth Circuit's interpretation of materiality, but then went on to say that, in fact, the court should not review this case, should not weigh in on what the materiality standard should be, because this was not a good vehicle for the Supreme Court's review. And one of the reasons that they gave is that if the case were to be remanded back to the district court, the United States would actually move to dismiss the case. And they specifically mentioned the burden that would be placed on the government and on the agencies from discovery related to materiality and the need to make requests under these TUI regulations of government agencies. And so we see here the government is explicitly dismissing because of the burden that materiality discovery would place on the government agency. This is coming fairly late in the process. Historically, defendants have advocated for dismissal in connection with a declination. But what we see now with Gilead, for example, is that as the case moves forward, as it goes through, you know, a round or two of motion to dismiss briefing, it may become much clearer what the theory is, what the requirements to show materiality will be, whether that's going to be resolving a dispute about what the government knew, or taking that even further and inquiring into the agency's thought processes. And so it creates a new opportunity, I think, for defendants to really aggressively try to use materiality both as a litigation strategy in the court and filing motions to dismiss, seeking discovery in the normal litigation process, but also stepping outside of that process to use it as another opportunity to ask the government to step in and dismiss the case. And you see in Gilead that explicit desire to do so.
It's interesting. Pre-Escobar, a lot of times the position that the government would take, and again, I was someone who was in that position making these arguments several years ago, was, you know, look, in a False Claims Act case, the conduct at issue is the defendant's conduct. I think with Escobar, it's sort of discovery the government's gotten on equal ground. What the government thought, knew, approved, that is just as important in order to evaluate a False Claims Act case. And I think that's what really the true effect of elevating materiality does, is that it changes kind of the way that discovery takes place in cases in ways that will create additional burden for the government.
I think that also goes to a second consideration, which may not be at the forefront of the government's mind, but certainly comes into play as a general concern, is whether we're able to get these cases right without getting all of that information from the government. And so one case that really comes to mind is the Trinity Industries case, which is actually from the end of 2017, but I think we'll continue to see ramifications and sort of the results of that case influence the government's decisions and influence how the litigation writ large of materiality moves forward. The case involved some highway guardrails. So the relevant agency was the Federal Highway Administration. And what ended up happening is that the agency provided information, but very late in the game, in some instances almost on the eve of trial. And they ultimately provided a report that said, in effect, that the guardrails at issue, which the relator alleged were unsafe and should not have been paid for by the government, actually were safe, and the government continued to pay for them, and that, in short, it was not material. But that evidence came so late in the game that there ended up being a very sizable jury verdict that was ultimately reversed by the Fifth Circuit. And so you see this instance where, in effect, you have the relator arguing that something was material, even though the federal agency is saying it was not material. And so you could end up with scenarios like in Harmon Industries where the fact-finding process gets it wrong because of a lack of information or information coming at the wrong time in the process because of the government's ability to use the TUI regulations to provide that information on their own timeline rather than on the court's timeline or the litigation's timeline. And I think it begs the question of whether that result was really in the forefront of the government's mind when they wrote the statement of interest in Campy, that they're concerned about that kind of situation happening again, and that's a reason to dismiss the case. And that's actually not the only jury verdict that's been reversed on a materiality ground. You see the same thing happening in a Florida district court in 2018 in the Ruck case, where a jury awarded a sizable verdict, and the court ended up reversing that on materiality grounds. That case is currently on appeal to the 11th Circuit, so it'll be interesting to see what happens there. But the different rules that would apply to the government in terms of providing information do, in a certain sense, cripple the fact-finding process that we expect our courts to engage in through litigation. And so that fairness aspect of it and whether we can really litigate these cases in the way that our justice system is set up to find facts and determine liability, I think is another question that's open and we'll see develop further as these cases and as these arguments continue to move forward and be made.
Which is probably a good jumping off point for us to talk a little bit about kind of thinking ahead and being a little bit forward looking with respect to Escobar and what we think is going to be happening going forward. I mean, obviously this issue of the two-part test with respect to determining falsity is an open one. There's a circuit split. Whether it makes its way back up to the Supreme Court is unclear, but it's certainly one that's going to continue to be litigated. And, you know, given the fact that the issues implicated, you know, whether or not a false statement was made or whether or not a noncompliance was disclosed or both, you know, that's so fact specific that it's not surprising that it's taking a while for some of these issues to be fleshed out. What will be interesting to see is the point that we were just talking about, which is to what extent is the government going to use its power to dismiss, to address some of these issues of agency burden, some of these issues of circumstances where relators are pursuing what the government knows to be purely meritless cases. But certainly Escobar creates a basis under both reasons for dismissal.
We also expect to see litigation in the courts developing related to the materiality. As we mentioned, I think we expect to see litigation in the discovery context related to what kind of discovery can be sought from the government and how that discovery is sought. But as these cases make their way through, I think we'll also see more summary judgment opinions addressing materiality. So the factors that the Supreme Court laid out in Escobar are fairly fact-specific. They said what materiality is not and then described what would be strong evidence of materiality, which suggests a summary judgment opinion. And what we've seen in the past year or two since Escobar is that a lot of the decisions dealt with materiality at the motion to dismiss stage, and that obviously with fewer facts based on only the allegations in a complaint could only go so far in terms of fleshing out what that standard means. I think we expect to see that standard become fleshed out even more as those cases make it to summary judgment and we see litigation based on real examples rather than just allegations.
And I think a lot of the reaction of the government is also going to be contingent on how cases are actually litigated by defendants. And I mean, as you know from cases that you and I are working on together, we and represent clients are thinking about pretty aggressive discovery strategies with respect to the government and cases where, the materiality issue is in play, which is basically all of them. But, you know, it's something where we've sat down with our clients to think about like sort of defense strategies in cases. I mean, it has involved thinking through robust ways to do fact finding with respect to government knowledge and on the materiality issue. And so I think we're not the only ones, obviously. It's a strategy that is widely being deployed by a lot of defense counsel. And the government's going to start to feel the pain of that, I think, a little bit. And it'll be interesting to see to what extent they react to that. One final topic is, what do we think companies should do on a day-to-day basis based on the fact that, you know, you have these changes in the law and there may be some ways to position themselves to be ready for, you know, the key TAM that may come down the road? And it really raises a couple of issues. Number one, how should a company that does business with the government or receives reimbursement for health services from the government, to what extent should they be engaging the government? You know, how candid should they be and what kind of discussions should they have with the government going forward in order to sort of bolster the materiality point? And it really does open the door to really thinking about that very deeply. I mean, I think that if it's a circumstance where there's ambiguity and it's 50-50, then it may weigh in favor of reaching out to the government, talking to the contact on a contract, or reaching out to if there's a advice or guidance branch in the agency that is overseeing the contract or the claims at issue, to sort of get some guidance about what's appropriate or not. Because doing so and doing a memo to file reflecting that advice, or if it's written advice, you know, obviously you have the written advice and you can deploy it later on, it really does help to, you know, mitigate any argument down the road of in terms of the materiality. It's like, okay, we discussed the issue with the government. They gave us some feedback. They continued to pay on the claims. That's the classic sort of it was an immaterial claim argument defense that you can assert later on. So there's ways I think that companies should think about it. And I'm not saying that you necessarily do it in every circumstance, but certainly thinking about the possibility of doing so is helpful. And it's also just helpful from a general perspective, too, in terms of False Claims Act defense, because one of the things that the department looks at is whether or not if there is an issue, you disclosed it. And if you disclose it, it could have an impact on any resolution if there is liability there. So there's that general sense, but on a sort of more day-to-day practical point, even if it's not a large issue that you identified, a clear issue of liability, even if it's a little bit grayer, it's definitely something worth talking about, you know, within the company you know, or with counsel that advises on a regular basis on regulatory issues about whether or not to be a little bit more affirmative in disclosing an issue or talking about an issue with the government in order to foreclose any future False Claims Act case.
Yeah, that really goes to the issue that some courts have raised about a problem of proof when it comes to materiality. And so throughout our conversation here today, one of the things that has come up is the difficulty in obtaining the evidence that you might need to show that the government knew that certain requirements weren't met, which the Supreme Court in Escobar, beginning this whole conversation, this whole development of the law, suggested was very strong evidence of materiality. And so knowing now that that's the direction that the case law is going in, and that's the direction that the government is really going in their thought process about how these cases should be handled, it's an opportunity for defendants to make sure that they've kept those communications that could be that evidence moving forward. Because to the extent that the issue is whether the government knew about certain things and defendants are telling them about them, simply doing something as easy as keeping those communications could go a long way towards making sure that that evidence of materiality is at the ready should there be some sort of False Claims Act issue later on.
Yeah, I mean, in light of TUI, the TUI regulations, which give them basically a ton of discretion with respect to what information can provide when they're not a party in a declined case, having your own records and your own sort of information reflecting dialogue with the government about the issues that may ultimately be part of a QTAM suit is, I think, only a beneficial type of self-help that could best position a company in light of a potential action down the road. Well, thanks, Sarah, for joining me today on the podcast. It's certainly been an interesting year with respect to developments post-Escobar. And I think we've had a robust discussion here today about some of the challenges and some of the legal issues coming up, as well as some of the practical considerations. You know, Sarah and I are always available to help work through these types of challenges and issues. And if anyone has any further questions, feel free to reach out to us. You can find us, our contact information, on HoganLevels.com. And we look forward to you joining us on future podcasts on the False Claims Act and legal developments and practical developments related to the False Claims Act and its enforcement. Thanks very much.
Thanks for joining us today. For additional analysis on this topic and others around the FCA, please download our latest publication, False Claims Act 2018 and the Road Ahead, from HoganLevels.com.